And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Laurie Houston, Intuitive Soul, clearing a path to divine consciousness. And this is the second interview tonight. And this is a great interview with Scott Bloom, who is the co-founder of the inspirational website Daily Om, which I've heard of and have spent a great deal of time on, and has also written a book called Waiting for Autumn, which is a semi-autobiographical story. So welcome, Scott.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, the story starts at a certain point in your life, and I don't know how much of this is Scott's story, but tell us about how you got to where you are now. Like, how did you get to even to this point? And, you know, obviously this journey of yours, this spiritual aspect, which is, comes strongly through the book, has to have been fostered at a much younger age.
Yes, actually, that's true. Many of the experiences in the book actually did happen to me, especially the more intense metaphysical type experiences. But they happened over the period of about 20 years. So the book is categorized as fiction because I used a fictional thread to tie everything together, so it wouldn't come across as simply a collection of diary entries.
Right.
So that's the way that the book was written. I actually had my own spiritual awakening at a pretty early age, about 15, 16 years old. And I was fortunate to find a sort of a spiritual leader, guru type person that took me under his wing. And he was very adept at getting me into many intense metaphysical type experiences. But unfortunately, he wasn't very good at getting me out of them. And so he let me abandon me in some pretty serious situations where I really needed to choose whether I was going to be able to continue to living on to live on this earth, or if I was going to have to surrender to to the spirit world.
Right.
And I did, in fact, choose to remain on the planet, but in order to do that, I really needed to forego all of my spiritual practices, and I essentially put that part of me away for almost 15 years, because it was almost like I was an alcoholic. If I had just one more spiritual type experience, that I felt that I was going to lose myself forever.
Wow.
And so I did put all of that on hold for about 15 years until my wife Madison had her spiritual awakening. Unfortunately, her spiritual awakening was centered around more earth-based spiritual practices, where my previous experience was more spirit-based. And by doing that, I felt a lot safer and was able to reintegrate my spirituality with my daily life. And that happened a few years before founding Daily Om. With my wife Madison, and then we moved to Ashland, Oregon, which was very near where I grew up, where I had my first awakening. And since then, I was able to essentially integrate what had happened with the past with the present, and I feel a lot more full and fulfilled now than I did back then. So that's kind of what brought me here.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, that so that aspect of the book where you talk about, you know, having to make that choice, that it was something that really was a part of your journey.
Yes, actually, it was a very intense part of my journey. It was one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make in this lifetime, for sure.
Wow. And was it because of something that happened that you were supposed to have passed on at an earlier time in your life, or was it just that you are so interconnected or interwoven into that spiritual dimension that it's very strong pull?
Well, it was basically that when you start spending time in the spirit world and embrace some more intense metaphysical type practices, you find yourself in a very vulnerable position, and so protection is a very important part of that. And since I wasn't trained properly and I was a young age, I just went in, completely blind, and found myself addressing some less than you know, positive influences in the spirit world. So I did basically confront negative energy forces, and I was being pulled in that direction. So that's basically what I was trying to get out of. Is it's a lot of fun, and there's a lot to experience, and it's very enlightening. But you also don't have the protection of your physical body, which is an awful lot of protection that we don't really realize until we strip that from ourselves.
Hmm.
So that's sort of what I was dealing with.
And ironically, I think most people believe that, you know, it's our spirit that is, you know, the strongest, and, you know, that's where we don't get, you know, the problems that we seem to have. So it seems that you're sort of telling us the opposite.
I guess so. I mean, I don't really think of it as the opposite. I just think of it as you just don't have as much protection. So everything is more intense, and everything is more pure. And so, you know, that's one of the things I was talking about in the book, where mm-hmm. Especially in this day and age, many people, you know, more in the New Age type movement, or the New Thought movement, depending on how you want to describe it, don't really embrace the idea that there is evil in the world.
I know.
That it's really all about, you know, us, and we all have good, we all have bad, and it's just a matter of tapping into, you know, the intention, which is, you know, true within ourselves. However, there are others that choose, you know, the darker side as where they want to remain. And so when you don't have that physical protection of your body, that can seep into your soul very easily.
And from what I understand, that you know, that process, you know, is a choice, I guess, that we make consistently into, you know, what we choose as our life experience and our soul experience, because it is, you know, there's a certain amount of power, and there's a certain amount of draw that, you know, can get us confused. And usually that's, you know, one of our biggest tests, is to determine, you know, at what point do you make that decision? At what point do you know that it's about love and light versus, you know, that power struggle, or that, you know, that shadow side within us, you know, that can take over?
Yeah, that's part of it. I think that's a little bit different than what I was addressing, but definitely that's part of our you know, our conscious choice, and the first part of our spiritual journey, especially here on Earth, that we do need to identify with ourselves and overcome our own, or actually integrate our own shadow with our you know, with our intention. So we're not trying to subvert it. That's a very important, you know, important part of living on Earth, is to realize that this is definitely a part of us. And so, although that's different, a little bit different than what I was talking about, it's a huge, important part of ourselves, because if we do subvert our shadow, it will come bubbling up in unexpected moments and consume us in pretty ugly situations. So that's actually very true.
Would our shadow not be part of, you know, our soul?
Yes, I would say that in general, a lot of that type of work is really tools for to deal with living on this earth. Yes, I would say that our shadow is definitely part of our soul, but the intention that we provide ourselves when we're going out into the world, and this is, you know, in the physical world or the spirit world, it's the most important part. So if we're coming at it from a place of love, and it's best to remember that the sort of the protoplasm, if you will, of our soul is the energy of love. And so it's almost, that's the purest form of energy. And so as we bring these other intentions into it, it does cloud it a bit. But if we can come back to, you know, clearing our mind as much as possible, that's when we come to love. And so that whole process of self-love and, you know, self-acceptance is part of integrating the shadow. So that's why if we're coming from that intention, then we don't have to really think of it as separate from ourselves.
Right. And so you do talk about protection in the book, and you were able to get someone from your ancestral line to assist you. Is that how it happened, or were you able to find someone in the physical that taught you?
Well, this is where the fictional thread sort of separates a little bit from reality. As I explained at the beginning, the way that I dealt with protection is essentially subverting my spirituality for 15 years.
Oh.
And so that wasn't, I would say, the most positive or helpful way of dealing with it. So what I did when writing the book is there's a character, a homeless man named Robert, that's a central part of the story. And what I did is I essentially attributed 20 years of life lessons to the character Robert. Mm-hmm. So giving, creating a guru that actually did have the experience to help me with protection, by attributing all of the life lessons I had to the guru I wish I would have had. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how that happened. And although I am beginning to integrate and communicate with my ancestral line, which is, a really important part of our spiritual development, unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that at the time when I had these difficult situations.
Right. It makes me think of, how important it is that we do get that guidance, whether that comes from within us or whether that comes from, someone outside us. But it obviously is an important aspect of, all of our journeys to discover what's in us, by either looking, very deeply within and understanding, as you say, that shadow part and accepting that part and integrating it, or by, finding somebody that will assist us.
Yes, absolutely. It's very important.
Hmm. Now, in the story, Robert was a walk-in. Have you met many walk-ins?
I have to say I've met a lot more since the book came out. it's something that it's a really difficult thing to identify because many walk-ins don't remember. I first became very, very conscious of my own life at a very young age. I would say about 3 months. And although one can say, okay, well, if you don't remember before 3 months, perhaps you just were a baby and you just haven't, you just don't remember. But it's such a strong memory that I do try to come to terms with what happened before that, because there is a little bit of a gap there. But it's definitely something that is a lot more common than we know. That being said, it's also difficult to remember what's happened before. So that transition between the spirit world and the physical world is often obscured by our memory.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting. It's a very interesting concept, and I don't think a lot of people, necessarily understand it or, believe in it. But I do. I have as well had experiences of something similar. So it's really a matter of your beliefs and your experiences and how you perceived those.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of awareness. I mean, just to clarify, the concept of a walk-in is essentially that there's an agreement before one is born. It doesn't always happen that way, but usually there's an agreement that says once you're done with the body that you're going to be given on the earthly plane, there's an agreement that another soul can come in and use that and continue to use that body after your soul has exited it. So instead of the soul leaving at the same time that the body is no longer being used, that another soul can come in and continue to use that body. And the advantage for the second soul to do that is that the existing body already has gone through a certain amount of training or growing or whatever, so it can like begin to use the body almost immediately. For example, they could walk and talk, and they could be actually in a particular place they need to work on, and something like that. So that's basically the concept of a walk-in. This is a lot different than a lot of people confuse that with possession, where a spirit would come in and take over a body without the agreement of the, you know, of the soul that was originally in the body. That's a completely different thing. This is more of a friendly thing, as opposed to possession is more of an unfriendly thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just wanted to clarify what that is for the people that haven't heard of what a walk-in was.
Right. And a lot of times they think it's, you know, the higher self or the oversoul that's coming in of that body so that they can, you know, continue the lessons that they're sort of on. But in some cases it's, you know, something completely different.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. So this book asked you a question near the beginning about, you know, are you ready to surrender your own experience to the universe? What does that mean to you?
Well, I think what that means to me is it's actually something that it's part of my daily practice, and has been for many years, is many of us really get caught up in the whole concept or the dichotomy between free will versus destiny.
Yes.
Do we actually have control of our life, or is the, you know, life predetermined for us? And you know, many of us feel like, well, there cannot be destiny, because if there was, what's the point of living? You know what? You know, if there's nothing I can do to you know, to influence my life, then what's the point? I should probably just give up. And in actuality, the answer is both. We absolutely have free will. However, we also have an agreement that we've made before we were born, sort of a soul contract with the universe, to determine specifically how we are going to accomplish what we need to accomplish while we're here on this planet. And we don't have to follow that. However, if we don't follow that, then we end up most of the time not learning the life lessons that we need to. And by not learning the life lessons that we need to learn, what happens is we end up having to come back. You know, if you believe in karma, that you need to come back a different lifetime to learn those lessons and to be able to move on. And so when you surrender to your destiny, surrender to the universe, you're not actually saying, okay, I don't have any more control of my life. But what you're really doing from a practical standpoint is being aware of the signposts that the universe gives you on a second-by-second basis to let you know that you're on your own personal destiny's path, and then making the decisions in order to flow with that. It's almost like if you end up fighting your destiny, you can do anything you want. Let's say, for example, you want to be, in your mind, you think it would be really cool to be a successful actor or make a lot of money or something like that. You can do that if you want to. But at the end of the day, you're going to be very, very exhausted, because you're essentially fighting against what your own destiny has done. You're essentially on your own when you're doing that work. And it's based on your sheer will and sheer you know, energy that you put in that you're going to be able to accomplish those things. As opposed to if you surrender to what your path is, although you'll still be making decisions on when to stay on that path and when to stay off of that path, whenever you're on the path, it's almost like being you know, in a stream. You have the support of the current of the universe behind you. And so you can get to where you want to be much faster. And then at the end of the day, you're also a lot more fulfilled. So at the end of the day, you're going to be able to sleep, you know, more soundly. You're going to be more well-rested. And then most important, you'll be more happy, because you'll be actually fulfilling your life's purpose. So that's what I mean by surrendering to the universe.
Okay. In that whole talk, which is great, because I think a lot of people don't understand what destiny means, and obviously we've been given free choice, and that's kind of what you've already touched on. So we have these contracts that we set up that we're here learning our lessons, and we're here to get certain aspects of that. And as long as we're moving in that direction, the choices we make are still our choices, but they, you know, they allow a certain purpose that we're here to do. What happens in those times when, you know, nothing seems to be working? Are we still, is it because we're getting lessons that we may need to learn, or is it because, you know, we're not in that flow and we're making choices against it?
Well, it could be both. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, first of all, the one thing that people, I think, misinterpret when it comes to sort of modern spirituality is many people feel like, okay, in order to follow your own destiny, what you need to do is to follow your bliss, right? People have said that before, follow your bliss, and so if you do whatever you do to make yourself happy, then that means you're living a full and spiritual life. That's actually not true. Many of the what we're here to do is primarily at the beginning of our lives to learn the lessons that we haven't learned before, and to acquire the wisdom from those experiences. Once we have that wisdom, then we're able to share that wisdom with others and then begin to do our life's work. The first step on most of our spiritual paths is to heal ourselves. Mm. And if there isn't anything to heal, then you don't really get any wisdom. So the universe does provide us with very, very difficult experiences. And I would say probably some of the most difficult experiences that we have in our life are not coming from not following our destiny, but in fact actually being forced to confront our destiny by the universe. And so these are, you know, more difficult type experiences, like maybe, you know, childhood trauma, being abandoned by parents, you know, loved ones dying, big things like that. Those are actually gifts from the universe. And I don't mean the experience itself to be the gift, but the gift is the wisdom that comes from that experience. But unfortunately, many of us actually bury that wisdom because they don't want to deal with it. They figure, like, you know, why should I wallow in this this pain? It's so painful. I would just like to move on and just forget about it. And so we have a tendency to subvert those difficult experiences because we don't want to deal with them, because we feel that, you know, confronting the pain is worse than you know, trying to ignore it. So what has helped me is that there's a traditional Native American practice that's helped me called soul retrieval, which I talked a little bit about in the book, where basically the Native American view of this situation is, when we have these difficult experiences that we're going through life on, we have that we're, you know, burying. The Native American view is we actually leave a piece of our soul at every one of these difficult junctures. And so as we get older and we have more and more of these difficult experiences in our life, we end up with less and less of our soul, less and less of our access to our soul. Of course, our soul still exists. It's just not integrated with our present being. What happens is that that's actually a gateway. The soul contains these tools that are useful for us to identify these spiritual paths and to identify our personal destiny through one of our most useful tools is our intuition. So the more that we go through our life and have less and less of our soul, we actually have less and less access to our intuition, which is why many of us, as we get older, begin to rely more and more on our intellect in order to determine some of these more important decisions regarding our life path. And that's completely irrelevant, because, you know, our intellect is a very useful tool. However, it's not designed to identify, you know, these spiritual signposts that allow us to figure out if we're on our destiny or not. So the Native American practice of soul retrieval is to actually to journey back, and that's a term, to journey back to that place in time where we had these difficult experiences and retrieve that piece of our soul and then integrate it with our present soul. And not only do we have more access to our soul, which gives us more access to our intuition, but more important, it actually gives us the wisdom that that came from that difficult experience. We can then integrate that wisdom and begin to use it on a daily basis. So, you know, from a practical standpoint, that means we won't be repeating the same mistakes again. And from a more lofty goal, we'll be able to then share that wisdom with others.
Mm-hmm. Now, in some cases, and not necessarily in this book, but a lot of times, you know, soul retrieval will go back into past lives where we have left pieces of our soul as well.
Absolutely. I would say a lot of the shamanic practices
that's true.
Don't really have the same constraints on time that we do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the past, present, or the future doesn't really matter to a lot of this work. And so when you first start doing soul retrieval type work, it's very possible that you might, you know, as you say, rewind to a past life or fast forward to a future life. But and that's what's sort of confusing when you first get started, because you're trying to figure out, well, I don't understand. I don't have these problems. It doesn't make any sense to me, because we might only have the memory of this particular lifetime. But once we realize that this is actually part of our own continuum, then we can get a lot from it.
And would part of, I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, us giving our power away. Is that similar to giving our soul away, or is that something completely different?
I think it's, for the most part, it's different. It could be related. Usually you don't give your soul away. The most of the time what you do is you would, if you're going to consciously give your soul away, it would usually be for a loved one,
right,
that you just want to give them as much of you as you can. And that's actually very unhealthy, because the person that you would be giving your soul to can't actually use it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then you don't have access to it either. And I do actually talk a little bit about that part of it in the book. But as far as giving your power away, I don't know. I mean, it's usually, if it's done out of love, then yes, that's true, that is similar. If it's done out of anything besides love and a conscious decision, having it taken away or that sort of thing, I think that's a little bit different. But
yeah.
I should probably meditate on that a little bit more now that I think about it.
Okay, great. We'll have you back.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Now, you talk also about, after you did the soul retrieval, you also did a support group and something called a constellation. Now, it's interesting. I think I'd heard about it a little bit before your book. After I read your book, which was in the summer, I heard about it quite a bit since. So it seems to be a powerful modality in assisting people.
Yes, absolutely. Well, going back to what I was talking about soul retrieval, and a little bit before when I was talking about your first step of spirituality, most people's first step is self-healing. Once we have a tendency to get into self-healing, many of us find that we reach a plateau and we can no longer progress. And we're saying, okay, wait a second, I've been doing all of this work on myself and a lot has been, you know, healed. However, I'm still running into these same problems over and over, and I just don't understand why. After you have explored your own self-healing and everything that you do know, and then perhaps, you know, journey back to past lives or those types of things like we were talking before, it's very possible that the issues that you need to work on are from your ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes it's good to then look into ancestral healing, because what happens is we have a tendency to have these entanglements with our ancestors, where we're actually not getting the support that we should be getting from being part of an ancestral line. So the way we're designed to work energetically, as we get older through our ancestral line, everybody in future generations are designed to get more and more powerful, because we have the energy supporting all of supporting us from everybody that has gone before us in our ancestral line. Now, if for example, these pieces of our soul that we subvert because we don't want to deal with these painful situations, as I was talking before, if we don't deal, we successfully, you know, you're putting that word in quotes, successfully end up not dealing with these issues in our lifetime, when we die, they don't go away just because we die. They're actually passed on to our future generations.
Mm.
And so these are the entanglements that we need to deal with when we're alive. And that's also our responsibility, is if there are, you know, that we've been, this is a responsibility that we've inherited, that if we don't deal with these entanglements, those are passed on to our future generations as well. And so anyway, that's the whole concept of what is ancestral healing and why do you want to do it. Now, one of the ones that I've worked with that I find to be probably the most powerful form of ancestral healing is, as you mentioned, constellation work. And constellations were created by a German psychiatrist named Bert Hellinger. And essentially what it is it's spiritual theater or spiritual role-playing, depending on the way you look at it. But essentially what you do is you get a group of people that are coming into the constellation, and they form a circle around what's called the field. And so we, with intention, create a field where anybody that enters the circle has access to the different souls that are sort of in the ethers. Then let's say that we were going to be doing a constellation for you. You would then select different people to different people from the circle to represent the different aspects, the different people in your life that you believe are surrounding a particular problem that you want to resolve. Now, you, most of the time, although sometimes you do, but most of the time, you don't actually go into the circle yourself. You pick a representative to play, you know, to represent yourself, somebody maybe to represent your spouse, somebody to represent your child, and then you would put them into the circle. And you would stay out of the circle and watch what happens. At the same time, the facilitator would then use their connection with spirit, and they would begin to get information of other people or other souls that need to be brought into the field as well. So they might say, okay, I'm getting information that we should actually bring in your mother, your father, your mother's mother, and your mother's mother's mother. And they don't necessarily have to be alive in order to bring them in, because, you know, this is more of a collective field that has access to everybody that has gone before, as well as people that will be coming in the future. So then the people in the circle, and from a metaphysical standpoint, basically what's happening is they're channeling the spirits of these different people, and then they began to interact with each other. And by interacting with each other and acknowledging these entanglements and honoring them and bringing them out into the open, what that does is it unblocks those energy entanglements and allows the energy to begin to flow naturally. And I'm actually blown away every time I've ever been to a constellation where, for example, there would be two sisters that hadn't talked to each other in, you know, decades, complete estranged siblings, and one of them was doing a constellation about it. The other one, you know, hadn't been spoken to in many, many years, and there's no way they could have heard of what happened. And then within days after the constellation has happened, the other sister called the one sister and made amends. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of really healing a lot of things that when you might not have access to, you know, to everybody, because they might have gone by or they're not in the same area or whatever. It's really powerful.
Hmm. Yeah, it would be. So you're big on some sort of support group, whether it's, you know, going to your own individual counseling or working through, but to get some sort of support while you're working on this planet in this physical dimension.
Well, I wouldn't say that I would say that that's worked for me,
mm-hmm.
is what I would say. I think everybody has their own path, and all of these modalities are very useful to certain individuals. I don't think that they're all useful to everyone,
mm-hmm.
but through my book and through, you know, this conversation, I would hope to convey that, you know, any of these ideas may or may not work for you, mm-hmm. but the point is to be open to them and to follow your own inner voice and your own inner guidance and let your intuition guide you to whatever is going to work for you. You know, some people, for example, get a lot out of organized religion. Some mm-hmm. people get a lot out of doing daily meditations or going to, you know, 21-day silent retreats. And other people like me get, you know, a lot of out of you know, soul retrieval or constellation work. So I think it just the point is to be open to whatever works for you, and there's no wrong answer. This is all right. If it works for you, then that's beautiful.
Mm. Perfect. So in your book, you talk a lot about, you know, the cycles of the moon. You talk a lot about, you know, connecting in with the earth. How important is that in your life?
I think it's very important. When I was coming back into my own spiritual practice about 15 years after I forwent it completely, my wife really helped me integrate with the cycles of nature, and that was, she was getting a lot of her strength from nature, and she still does. I look at this as part of what I do. But it was really an important part of it, because by honoring nature and trying to live within the cycles of nature, for me, for example, the cycle of the moon is really, really powerful, especially the day before a full moon. Not the full moon itself, but the day before is just an incredible time for me. You know, every time that it's at that place, but. Also, living within the cycles of the seasons is incredibly powerful. And at the time when we were having, I was having my reawakening, Madison was having her awakening, we were living in Los Angeles. And that was really a difficult place to live in the cycle of the seasons, because essentially in Los Angeles you have just one long season the whole year round, which is, you know, summer.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, what we did is it was the intention behind it and the honoring of the earth by beginning to eat with the cycle of the season. So that was a really powerful thing that was helpful for us, is to just go to, you know, more co-op type stores or health food stores that were giving food that were in season, and not saying, okay, well, it's December, I want a pineapple, let's just go eat a pineapple. It's more saying, okay, what's in season right now, and use that as an intention to integrate with the earth. And by doing that, we then, it's a two-way street, that we feed the earth energy and love by doing that, and then we receive the support of it by just being conscious. So that's been really helpful for me. And of course, now that we live in Ashland, Oregon, it's much easier, because, you know, every 3 months the seasons completely change. So we're, you know, we're hit over the head with it. And
mm-hmm.
right now it's changing into autumn right now, which is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about the energy of food and more conscious cooking.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, probably the most important part of being alive and the whole concept of having a soul is the concept of exchanging energy from one being to the next. And so whether, you know, we are doing something overt as receiving a Reiki session where, you know, somebody is using their connection to transfer energy, you know, using their hands onto your body, or you're just simply having a conversation with somebody that you might not even know, there's an energy exchange there. And so when somebody is preparing your food, the energy that they are putting into the food, whether they intend to or not, we will receive that energy when we ingest it. And so if somebody's in a very bad mood and they're, you know, they don't care, they hate their job because they're just in, you know, some minimum wage job that they hate, and they don't like their boss and they don't want to be there, and they're just, you know, making your food because they need to pay, collect a paycheck, that energy is going to go into your food, and that's going to go inside of you when you eat it. And so the more sensitive that you become and the more aware you are of energy, the more that you're going to actually reject that food. Like for me, I can't eat in a restaurant like that. I'll actually get sick to my stomach, to the point where, you know, I'm about to pass out if I find myself eating food that's been prepared in this manner. And so at this point, I'm very careful about the type of restaurants that I go to, and really talk about not only the consciousness of how the food was prepared. I mean, just because it's organic doesn't mean that it was prepared well. But that being said, most people that will, you know, spend the extra money on organic ingredients are usually more conscious people. So I wouldn't say that that's, you know, a rule of thumb, but it is kind of a guidance if you're going into a new town and you say, okay, well, where can I eat? If you can find, you know, the restaurants that are aware of those type of ingredients, they're usually more aware of their energy and trying to make sure that their employees are in a good mood and actually care about this.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that would go the same with, you know, animal products that we eat, if depending on how they were slaughtered and what kind of fear. And so that's when we get into doing blessings and, you know, praying, having a more conscious idea of, you know, what we are putting in our bodies, because I think, you know, a lot of times we're just not really aware of that. And you became aware of it because of, you know, the specific place you came from, as well as the spiritual journey you've been on. It's made you much more sensitive.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And all the things you're talking about are definitely important parts of all of that as well.
Mm-hmm. So it's the pre-production of the food as well as the, you know, the process of making it.
Yeah, and I would also say that at the end of the day, the most important thing that you can do is to honor, you know, the service that the plant or the animal has given by allowing you to be sustained by its energy. So if you can actually honor that beforehand, that goes a long way to, I would say, it's not maybe the right word, but sort of erasing, you know, the previous evils that have gone into the preparation and everything else. But I would say the relationship between you and the food itself is the most important part. And then, of course, then you get further, you know, down the food, down the chain of the preparation and harvesting of the food as well.
Mm-hmm. But I, you know, most people don't think that way. Most people are stressed when they're eating. They're eating because, you know, they're either in a hurry or they're, I mean, most people don't spend that time in awareness as they're eating.
Well, it's one of those things, you know, I think this kind of comes back to my overall philosophy of, you know, living a spiritual lifestyle or, is essentially, one of the things I like to say is enlightenment isn't really a goal. Mm-hmm. Enlightenment is a practice. And so it's more of a daily thing, a daily practice, that what you're trying to do is to try to live a spiritual lifestyle, not just when you die in order to get to heaven, but really this entire journey and every second of every day. And so as you can become more conscious of what you're doing every moment of every day and integrate that, so it's not a separate part of yourself, it's not something you just do on Sundays, it's not just something a goal that you have when you die, but really every second of every day, then that's when you're going to be living a much more fulfilled life and be able to integrate with your destiny. Eating is just, you know, a natural extension of that, because you're like, okay, this is what I'm doing this second. So, you know, how do I eat more consciously? How do I say hi to somebody more consciously? How do I go to sleep more consciously? How do I wake up more consciously? It's all part of it. It's not like it's this, you know, this hard, difficult thing. It's just being aware of it. And you don't have to, like, you know, slow down your life or not do certain things or whatever, but it's just holding that intention to the point where hopefully, maybe it'll take a couple of years, but after that, it just becomes second nature and it's just the way you live.
Hmm. Nicely said. How important was Kirtan to your journey?
Well, I think that Kirtan is a really beautiful ceremony, and I'd say one of the things that I've been a big fan of music my entire life, and I find a lot of nurture from listening to music, and I listen to all kinds of music. I don't listen to just spiritual music, but the concept of sound healing and using you know, sacred chants and devotional intention to heal is really, really powerful. And the thing that's special about Kirtan is that you are not only just listening to somebody, but you're involved in it as well. And so when you have, you know, 50, 100, 200 people chanting these sacred chants that have been used for thousands of years, all together, the amount of energy that's sent to, you know, the divine and then is received by everybody involved is immense. And you know, some of the most powerful experiences that, you know, I've ever had, as far as just feeling energy. I think it's a really beautiful thing. It's not something that has necessarily healed my own particular sort of life karma challenges. Mm-hmm. It's not like you know, I've done these, but I would say that it does give me a lot of insight, and it's more of a meditation, and more important, it just feels really good, and it's a lot of fun. So I would say, you know, if you haven't experienced Kirtan, I highly recommend it. And for the people that don't know what Kirtan is, it's East Indian devotional singing that sing these ancient chants. You might have, you know, heard a few of them, like Hare Krishna. Mm-hmm. The Hare Krishnas actually have popularized a lot of those. George Harrison from the Beatles also popularized a lot of Kirtan as well. So that's kind of it to give you a starting point. But I'd say, fortunately, a lot of places in this country actually have Kirtan, if not festivals, at least you know, occasional experiences. So I highly recommend it if you haven't done it before. It seems scary, but it really isn't. It's actually just a lot of fun.
Yes. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the spirit world, and, you know, you talk a lot about, you know, having lucid dreams and the dreamland, and I really found it interesting with your concept of, you know, how ghosts can get stuck in the dreamland, because a lot of times I think we think that they're, you know, in this physical world and stuck, and this takes a different angle to it. But, you know, talk about the different dimensions that you've experienced and what they mean to you.
Well, you know, as I was explaining before, I was sort of thrust into the spirit world where it's almost like the Wild West. It's like everything that has ever been is there, and everything that will ever be is there. And so it's incredibly vast and powerful and amazing. But as I mentioned, it's kind of scary, too, because it is like the Wild West. It's all there, the good and the bad. The dreamland is actually a great place to play around in, because a lot of the same rules apply in dreamland as they do in the spirit world, where, as far as, you know, lack of a body, being able to manifest things instantly, access to other souls. However, the difference is the only people that can come in, the only souls and energy that can come into your dreamland are the ones that you invite yourself. And so it's a really good kind of like training wheels version of traveling to different dimensions is in your own dreamland, as well as being able to have access to a lot of you know, others that travel as well. So you know, Native Americans have been using traveling to dream for many, many years, and it's a really good way to communicate with loved ones, whether they're alive or not. So I highly recommend spending time in dreamland, and then once you've got to that place, then you can essentially graduate to the more formal spirit world, where you have access to everything then. Not just people that you've invited, but everything else, and there's a lot that can be done there, but it does take a lot more protection and knowledge and wisdom to be able to navigate those waters. So the first step is to definitely start spending time in your dreams and actually go through a lucid dream process where you can control your dreams and begin to remember them, and so you can start integrating those with your conscious with your conscious life, and then be able to influence those as you go. So that's a good first step, and I highly recommend that.
I mean, I've heard lots of people talk about the different types of dimensions, so that they wouldn't say that, the spirit world is the one that's all-encompassing, but that there are different dimensions upon dimensions that will take you into different areas and different places, and some are, completely bad, and some are completely good, and your experience seems to be quite different.
Well, you could say the same about the Earth, right? Where you can say, okay, it's just Earth, or you can say, well, there's Europe and there's Asia, and there's New York, and within New York you have the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and you also have these scary back alleys, and so you can say that they're all different names, and say that okay, well, these scary back alleys is where the evil people live, and that's partially true, but it's not completely true. So it's not quite as cut and dried as all of these different things. But I understand why some people put different names on it, because it's easier to describe that way.
Right. One of the last questions in your book is, how can I make the most positive impact with my life? How has that influenced your life purpose or your life flow?
Well, I think that's really coming back to the being conscious of our own personal destiny. And, I think we're all here to make the world a better place than it was before we got here, which, unfortunately, over the past few hundred years, we haven't actually followed that as a race. But I would say that once we are conscious of the fact that we all do have a personal destiny, and there is a very meaningful life that we have to live that's going to really be beneficial, and not only be beneficial for the entire universe, but very specific reasons on and ways to go about that, that we're going to then have the support of the universe and be able to live an incredibly more much more fulfilling life. And so I, at this point, I think that's a really good first question to ask, is how am I going to make the most out of my life? And at this point, I believe that I try my best to just live that way, every day. And although I do have a tendency, to fall off of my path quite regularly. In fact, I would say that I probably fall off of my path at least, 2,000 or 3,000 times a day. I'm actually totally fine with that, because at least I'm realizing that I'm on the path, and I realize that I've fallen off of it. So the main thing that I would say to people out there is, don't get hard on yourself if you fall off of your own path and you do something that's not really a service to your higher good. That's okay. At least you're acknowledging it, and at least that you're recognizing it. And the hardest part is, and the worst part is when people are completely apathetic, or they just are simply unaware of the fact that they're on or off of a path. And so once you get to the place where you're actually aware, and that's why people use the term being conscious. If you're conscious of what's actually happening, that's the majority of the work. And so don't get hard on yourself, because that's all part of the process.
Hmm. Well, this is an enjoyable little book that you've written, and I think, you know, it touches on, as you can see, you know, some very deep, deep topics, and I think it gives people, you know, an opportunity to start asking themselves some of these questions and to become more aware of what they're doing and their eating and everything that's we've discussed. Now, you did do a prequel to this book after.
Yes, actually, I wrote the prequel after Waiting for Autumn. The prequel is called Summer's Path, and however, we did put it out in an early form on the internet as an ebook before Waiting for Autumn came out, but it was only out for a couple of weeks, and we retrieved it, so it's no longer available. And since then, since Waiting for Autumn's come out, I've actually been working on expanding Summer's Path, and I've added two additional chapters to it, and that is going to be coming out in April of 2010.
Thanks.
And so that will be the and that'll be coming out in hardcover. So that'll be the next book for me, and that's the 3 months before Waiting for Autumn.
Cool. And, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about Daily Om?
Sure. Well, Daily Om is an inspirational website. We send out inspirational messages to our subscribers. We have three different newsletters. The main newsletter is the inspirational message. The second is a daily horoscope, and we also have daily music recommendations.
Nice.
In addition to that, we have online courses with some of the best authors and luminaries in the spiritual movement, where you can take in-depth courses from authors such as Debbie Ford or Neil Donald Walsh, Gay Hendricks, different people like that. Actually, we just have this amazing course that we just launched with Andrew Harvey called A Year of Rumi, and there's a new Rumi poem every day. So there's all kinds of different content that you can go on, and there's also teleconferences and things like that going on. So
nice.
It's pretty special. We started it in 2004, and now we have over 1 million subscribers. So it's really helping a lot of people. We're really happy with it.
And it's you and your wife that are doing it?
Yes. My wife is responsible for all of the content on Daily Om, and I do the sort of the business and technology stuff.
Wow. It's a huge project.
Yes, it is. It keeps us very busy. That's
I
for
bet
sure.
It does. When do you have time to write?
Oh, boy. usually about 4 a.m.
Oh, wow. Sorry I asked.
Yeah. Especially now that we just have a newborn baby. So, yeah, that's definitely putting some challenges on the whole writing and editing process. But it's a very full life that we're very, very lucky to have.
Blessed, yes. Wow. Well, Scott, it's been a great pleasure. I very much enjoyed hearing more about you and your concepts on life and your own spiritual journey and what you've learned. I think it's, you know, very beneficial for people. You know, we get these ideas and we read books and we, you know, we try and get to that certain place, but it doesn't often mean anything until we can have either our own experiences or actually understand somebody else's.
Well, thank you very much.
So I look forward to, you know, your next books, and I would love to have you come back.
That would be fantastic. Thank you very much.
All right. So thank you. And we'll be back next week. All right. Thank you, Scott.
Bye.
Bye.